Today on the Fanboy Smackdown, we talk to author, podcaster, and all-around pimp, T. Morris.
Hey, this is Tony, and with me today, the other Tony is not here, but I do have someone that that shares our common first initial, T. In fact, it is T. It's T. Morris.
It is T, yeah.
Yeah. Welcome, T.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to finally be on Fanboy Smackdown.
Thank you. And today we are going to talk about, at first we're going to talk about the new book.
We're going to shamelessly pimp me. That's what we're
going right. to
do.
That's right. That's right. Billabub Battings and the Case of the Singing Sword.
Yes.
Is that right?
You nailed it.
Cool.
Actually, Billabub is a much easier title, I notice, for people than Moravi. Although, ironically, Billy has been called a lot of different things. He's been called Bilbo. He's been called Billy Bob. And of course, that whenever someone calls him Billy Bob Battings, the first thing that pops in my head is a 4 foot one dwarf redneck, who's suddenly saying "Get her done."
But yeah.
like toe and mater. Billy is going to be launching as a podcast on Valentine's Day.
Right.
And I chose Valentine's Day because of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Brilliant.
One of the bad guys in the novel is Al Capone. And unlike Sigler's Rookie and Ancestor and his brilliant podcast, and unlike J.C. Hutchins and his Seventh Son trilogy, which if you're not listening to either one, just say no to crack and go on ahead and subscribe to both of these.
No kidding. I'm listening to both of these guys. And then they've got their new contest, too, to top everything off.
Yeah, their crossovers are phenomenal.
Yeah.
Unlike their podcasts, my podcast for Billy is a previously published novel.
Right.
And it's still in print, and it's still available at dragonmoonpress.com and at your favorite bookstore. And what it is, in a nutshell, is The Lord of the Rings if Mickey Spillane wrote it. That's what Billabub Battings is at its core. And the genesis of me deciding to do Billy as a podcast, when I first did Moravi as a podcast, it was specifically to promote the sequel, Legacy of Moravi, which was coming out that summer. And, right. When it comes to being in, people say, oh, were you an early adopter to podcasting? I'm usually the person that says no. I'm the guy that actually started the podcast novel.
Yeah.
I was the first guy, and I had no fracking clue what I was doing. In fact, me, Scott, and Mark Jeffrey, none of us knew what we were doing. We just were like, well, let's do this. This may be cool. And next thing we knew, we started something big.
And all three books are great. I've listened to all three. I'm a horrible geek for podiobooks.com.
I'm very proud to be affiliated with.
Yeah, fully half the feeds that are in my iTunes are podiobooks.
It is so easy to do. That's the thing.
Yeah.
It's very easy to get caught up in the podiobooks rush. And I mean, I remember, just to share a quick story, I remember when I got the submission chapter for Seventh Son. And that opening line, and I heard that opening line, and I was like, holy cow, this guy's coming out with guns blazing. And then he had the four-year-old, am I allowed to cuss on this show or no?
You know what? We go both ways, so okay. We'll go ahead and throw the explicit tag. That's fine. Go for it.
Okay, fine. Well, when he had the four-year, when Hutch had the four-year-old boy say, go fuck your mother.
That was.
I just thought to myself, this guy's insane, and I love it. And it took me a while.
Just the guts it took to open the book that way. It was It was like either this guy has just either huge balls or he really knows what he's doing, and he's going to back this up all the way. And I've been on that ride ever since. It's great.
I mean, when you start a book that strong, you're either blowing your wad right there and then in the first chapter, or you're letting, like you said, you know what you're doing. And it's very clear Hutch knows what he's doing.
Yes.
And it's just been getting better and better as it's been going on. But the premise of me doing Moravi as a podcast was to promote Legacy. Well, Billabub Battings and The Case of the Pitcher's Pendant, which is the second book in that series, That's supposed to be coming out in 2008, sometime in 2008. Excellent. That's all I know. Well, obviously, I'm going to be finished with the podcast. So the question is, okay, you're not promoting Billy. Why are you doing it? And I will just tell you honestly, the reason why is because of Scott and Hutch. I mean, when they started doing the trash talking back and forth to one another, I was on a drive back from a con in Rochester, New York, and uh-huh. I said, I got to get on this action. I've got to get in on this action. And while I'm driving, you know, of course, when you're driving long distances to a con and you've got 8 hours and you're listening to podcasts and you're listening to these two friends of yours, the guys that you roomed with, and I survived.
Yeah.
The two guys you roomed with at Dragon Con, and they're trash talking each other. And you know, they're just playing with each other. I just said, I got to get on this. And then that was when I got the inspiration for that first teaser trailer.
Yeah, those teasers are great. We're going to go ahead and make sure that probably by the time this airs, one of the teasers will have been on already, and we'll probably go ahead and play the other one during this at some point.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, I had a ball mixing those, but it was a bit like a touch of nostalgia because I had asked earlier from my other podcast, The Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy, I asked Scott and Hutch to help me out with a quote-unquote aside, you know, about what would happen at Dragon Con if I won both parsecs that I was nominated
for. Yeah, I remember hearing that.
And yeah. I tried doing impersonations of them. And I'm just like, no, I need their voices. And when I approached them with this idea, they were like, oh, hell yes. And both of them stepped up to the plate. They were great sports about it. And then when I approached them with this promo, they were like, oh, yeah, absolutely, T. And Scott was a delight, and Hutch was a delight. I mean, it was a really, really – those promos would not have been as good as they were if they hadn't stepped up to the plate and said, sure, we'll do that.
I blame them for getting me into this. They're fully into it.
Oh yeah,
it's great.
And they're actually going to be guest voices. Scott's going to be playing Benny Riletto.
Yeah.
In episode 4, and then later in the book, Hutch is going to be playing both Agent Smith and Agent Williams. I believe is their name. I said Hutch. I got the perfect role for you. You're going to be playing government agents, but they're both going to be done by you.
That's
brilliant.
And they're
both going to be in the same room.
that is brilliant. He's got a great mastery of his voice to give a unique voice in the audio to every one of those clones.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, and the best part about this whole experience about getting out to Dragon Con and getting out to the Portable Media Expo was I got to put faces with these voices that I've been listening to for the longest time. And, you know, Scott talks like a badass and he is a badass, but he's a badass that is in your corner until you cross him. And unfortunately, I'm worried that I might've crossed him because, I gotta make my penance. Recently, 24 had their 4-hour premiere.
Right.
And Scott and I are both huge 24 heads.
As am I.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Jack is back. And you know,
yes, he is.
God, brilliant. And in the last 10 minutes of 24, I mean, it was just bam, 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 bam. And when I was done, I felt like I needed a cigarette, you know, and I instantly pinged Scott on Skype, and I just did, this happened, all in the last 10 minutes. God damn, I love 24. And I hit send.
Oh, no.
And then I suddenly was like, wait a minute, asswipe. He's on the West Coast, and he hadn't seen it. And then Scott just started sending me the siglerisms, as I like to say. One of them was "Get thee back, Satan," you know. So I'm calling it my evorific moment. So bad because, you know, Scott is just as much into 24 as I am, and the fact that I pulled that on him, I'm sure he still enjoyed it because you know. You know, it's hard not to. I mean, I've read all the Harry Potter books before seeing the films,
sure.
And I still held my breath at some point.
Yeah, so. and I mean, last season with 24, we have the dual DVRs in the house and everything else, and we ended up storing, I think, probably about 18 hours of it at one point. So we had some pretty big stuff spoiled. And, you know, I have no problem giving spoils for last season. I've spoiled movies the weekend after they come out, so I have no problem giving last season's TV shows. But like when Edgar died, you know, we ended up finding out about that. But it was one of those things that even though you knew it, you didn't know how it was going to play out. And
right.
And still
right.
to see how everything fell together was you didn't lose anything by knowing that.
And I think that's for me, that's part of the brilliance of 24. I mean, I know that, you know, being the quote-unquote professional writer that I am, I should be dedicating my, you know, I should be dedicating my resources and my time and my concert. Oh, fuck that. It's 24,
no,
okay?
No, I mean, and you have to have you have to have the blow off. I mean, 24 is it's candy.
It's definite candy. It screams Jerry Bruckheimer, but it's not Bruckheimer. It's Joel Silver, the guy who did the Matrix movies,
right?
Or as I like to say, the Matrix movies and the other two.
Yeah.
I mean, but at the same time,
but see, you're also talking to somebody who's not a fan of any of the Matrix movies. So,
you didn't like any of them.
By the time I got to the third one. Mm-hmm. I had built such a level of dislike for the whole thing that I enjoyed the last half of the third one. I completely didn't care, and it was
obviously neither did the Wachowski brothers when they made the third film.
No, yeah. and just that final sequence was probably one of the greatest car chases not done in cars that I'd seen in a long time. I just had a blast just sitting back and watching everything blow up.
I just for me the first in fact it was funny when I write I listen to movie soundtracks. That's how big of a movie junkie and a movie soundtrack junkie I am. As a matter of fact, I have two CD collections. I have my regular mixed artist CD collection, and then underneath that I've got shelves and shelves of movie soundtracks. And I was listening to the Matrix, the original Matrix, and I found out how much I loved the score of the first Matrix film. And the second Matrix had a brilliant score as well. But it was just the second movie was just so convoluted. And I thought to myself, okay, they're gonna make up for this with the third one. And by the point where they basically turned it into, you know, okay, let's take this last recent game of Robotech that we played and let's just turn that into a movie script.
Yeah.
I said, you know, I'm done with this.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely and positively done with this. You know, the one thing you can say in favor of the Matrix trilogy versus the new Star Wars trilogy that Lucas gave us, at least with the Matrix, they had one good movie.
the first episode of the Fanboy Smackdown, we discussed Star Wars. And I actually...
No, do you mean the new trilogy or do you mean the real trilogy?
All six. And actually, there is no Star Wars trilogy. None. Mm. There are two single films and two duologies. Films. Well, if you number the episodes the way I looked at it, at least episodes 1 and 4 are standalone pieces. They the story that is told in those is wrapped up in each of those movies. Empire doesn't exist without Jedi. Jedi doesn't exist without Empire. And the same goes with 2 and 3.
Yeah. Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith.
Right.
I give you that.
And
yeah.
I mean, by the same token, as fun as Empire is, and I've lost cred in some people's eyes for saying this, Empire is not my favorite Star Wars movie, and it's one of my bottom three Star Wars movies just because of how incomplete it is.
And, you know, it's funny. You talk about losing cred. I lost a lot of cred this summer. when I went on a couple of podcasts and I said, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, is going to be looked back. People are going to look back on that, and they're going to call that the Empire Strikes Back of the Pirates of the Caribbean trilogy.
Right.
And I say that because I'm old enough. I'm old enough to remember when Empire came out in the theaters.
Yeah.
And I remember people saying, you know, oh, I hated it. And they were comparing it to Star Wars. And I said, right. And I was like, why'd you hate it? Well, it didn't have a plot. It was really dark. It was really, really dark.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole lot of attention put on Han and not enough on Luke. And then the ending. What was up with the ending? It was a really unopened ending. And you look at what people are saying about Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
There wasn't much of a plot.
It's the same thing.
Same thing. Same argument.
Now, and I actually have not seen the second Pirates movie because I've heard that from so many people. I'm holding off on it and waiting until closer to the release of the third movie.
It was one of the things I actually, you know, because I got a 2-year-old, I couldn't get out to the theater as much as when my wife and I were huge Pirates junkies. And
yeah.
And we just, you know, we ate up the first one with a spoon, and then we got the DVD and we wore that one out. So, when we went to Pirates, every time we went back to see Dead Man's Chest, we caught something new.
Yeah.
And it was like, we were like, how did we miss that? And I really think that people need to, if they're comparing Dead Man's Chest to Curse of the Black Pearl, already they're shooting themselves in the foot. I don't think you can do that because you need to move. You know, that one's done. You need to move forward.
Right.
It has to be, in my opinion, it has to be a truly bad sequel if you're going, well, it wasn't as good as the first one. Case in point, Star Trek: The Motion Picture is a decent movie.
It is. I'll defend that movie. I will defend. Yeah. I will defend the first one.
I think now I will say this though. I think it is a good. It is a good, decent movie. Is it a good Star Trek film? Absolutely not.
No.
It's a horrible Star Trek film, because everyone is so stiff.
For my money, it's a good. It's actually a fairly good hard sci-fi movie.
Well, look at who directed it.
Yeah.
Robert Wise. And I was like, well, who is this guy, Robert Wise? And then I, you know, silly me, I asked, and then I found out, oh, he's the guy that directed The Day the Earth Stood Still,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, that was made in what, the 1950s? And it still stands the test of time.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now you look at Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. That is a great Star Trek film.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's not so much about the science so much as it is about the characters. It's about Khan. It's about Kirk. It's about the friendship between Kirk and Spock, et cetera, et cetera. Star Trek V, the Final Frontier, that's just a bad movie.
Final Frontier. Is that the one with the dolphins or the
no,
whales?
That's
Voyage Home.
That's Voyage Home. That was one of the good ones.
Yeah.
Five was the one that Shatner directed, and Five was the one with the where the Enterprise goes to meet God.
Oh, and yeah.
Yeah, train.
Yeah, that one.
Although
that one was
I will give Shatner credit for coming up with probably one of the best lines that Kirk has ever uttered in the entire series, was when he said, "Why does God need a starship?" I don't know why, but I really like that line.
Yeah, the Star Trek movies are an interesting anomaly that it seems that every so often they get it right, and they make a good Star Trek movie, and then they go back and try to make something else, and they end up just shooting themselves in the foot until they have to come back around and do it again. And I tell you, with all the news coming out about 11, I really don't know what to think.
Well, you know, I will give it the benefit of the doubt, because if they really do cast Matt Damon as a young Kirk and Ben Affleck as a young Spock, I could buy that.
I could too.
I could buy that. I could buy that. Now, my taste in Star Trek films tends to confound people, because when I look back on, when Star Trek Generations was coming out,
mm-hmm.
I was already not looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay, look, these folks have been, these folks did how many seasons of Star Trek, The Next Generation?
Yeah.
You know, they have more than established themselves. Why are we bringing in Shatner? You know, we don't, we, you know, no offense against Bill, because I think Bill, first off, I think Bill Shatner is, yeah, like I know him by far from my first name. I think old Billy, I think Bill Shatner is a genius on every level.
Yeah.
Because he has been able to take this, you know, what some people consider, you know, a career that has been pigeonholed by a campy 60s sci-fi film. And he has reinvented himself more in the past decade than some stars do in their 20s and 30s.
Well, and he's, it's even been more than that. I mean, he reinvented himself with T.J. Hooker, and, you know, he's constantly keeping himself out there. And
the other thing about him is that he even when he reinvented himself as Hooker, he never took himself seriously.
That's,
I remember
it.
When he was on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
and throughout the entire sketch, he was on the roof of the car.
Yep.
And at one point, he's writing a letter while still hanging on to the roof of the car.
Yep. Yeah, he's done some really great stuff with SNL. Between that and the skit at the convention.
Oh, yeah.
It's got to be on YouTube somewhere. If you don't know what we're talking about, go look for Star Trek Convention Saturday Night Live. It's got to be
on. Or do a search under Get a Life.
Yes.
Because that's what everybody calls it, the Get a Life sketch.
Yeah.
And not only that, but I mean, my wife and I just recently saw Over the Hedge.
Still haven't
and
seen
Shatner
that one yet.
And Shatner is brilliant in Over the Hedge.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the funniest. As much as I think Cars was a great film, but Over the Hedge was slap nuts fun.
Whoa. Hello.
You know, the joys of having a 2-year-old that doesn't want to take a nap.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So now Serena has been on Fanboy Smackdown.
Excellent. Excellent.
And no, that is not, no one is throwing her again. Please don't anybody call child services. That is Serena throwing her feet against the door and saying, "Hey, Dad, you're podcasting without me. How dare you?"
Right, right. Yeah, I remember the first couple of times we had Holden record something for us. The next morning, he walked up, saw the microphone sitting on the breakfast table. He said, "You know what that is? That's Fanboy Smackdown." Pointing right at the microphone. I said, you are so right.
Kids and podcasting, man. It's a dangerous mix.
Yep.
We start them young.
Yeah, so, we've been thinking about getting Holden to do a couple of reviews for us for some of the films that we take him to see.
I'd love to get a 4-year-old's perspective on Cars. I'd love to hear something like that.
We could hook him up and he can talk about it for hours. Actually, I think we can probably get him to recite most of the movie at this point.
I think that was part of what made I have nothing but, like I said, I'm nothing but high respect for William Shatner.
Right.
But bringing him into Generations, I thought was a mistake. And then came Final. And then came First Contact. And I was
wait a minute.
Okay.
Before we move on, let me go back to Generations for just a second.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Because I want to drill that one a little more. they take a couple of moments in what could be just absolutely brilliant. They could have been brilliant movie moments. And they just they lost it. I've only seen the movie like twice because of,
it's hard to sit through.
It is hard to sit through.
Yeah. It's hard to sit
through. The ribbon. There's a moment at the end of the film when Picard is given the opportunity to go back at any point in time. Earlier in the film, he was face to face with the bad guy on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And there were guards on either side of him. He could have gone back to that moment in time and said, "Arrest that man."
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because I'm the captain and I said so. Done.
Done. Thank you. Good night.
It would have been genius.
Yeah.
And, you know, let the movie end from there. Give it some nice little light, fluffy ending. I would have been thrilled with the movie if they had done something just kind of unique like that. And they had every opportunity to.
But here's
and they
the
had to waste
problem.
It with a fist fight.
Yeah, but here's the problem with time travel movies. Anytime you get... This is what I've noticed about time travel movies on a whole. When they're done right, they are phenomenal.
Yeah.
And when they're done wrong, it's like getting a tooth drilled without the Novocaine.
Yeah. The last regular show we did, we talked about time travel a little bit.
And did you guys happen to see Deja Vu?
Deja Vu. I have not seen that one yet, no.
It snuck in under the radar, and let me tell you something. I was impressed with how they pulled it off.
That is the new Denzel Washington flick.
Denzel
right?
Washington, a very pudgy Val Kilmer. Okay. And it's set in, it was actually the first movie that they filmed in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina.
Okay.
And, you know, now already people are turned off by Deja Vu because they see the word, they see the name Bruckheimer.
Yeah.
And he's now you see, he's the guy, in my opinion, he's the producer you either hate to love or love to hate.
Right.
Well, you know what? I love him. I've been a fan of Bruckheimer movies ever since, yeah, I'm going to say it. And you know, maybe the gaydar is going to go off for some people, but since Top Gun, I've been a fan of Bruckheimer movies.
Top Gun is a fun movie.
It's a fun, it's 80s.
Yeah.
Come on, we were all like that in the 80s. Yep. We were all walking around with the Ray-Bans going, that's right, Ice, man, I am dangerous.
Hey, man, you know, the first time I got a VCR with stereo outputs, I hooked that thing up to my stereo in my bedroom, and the first movie that I could think of to put in to get stereo sound coming out of my brand new Bose speakers was Top Gun, because I wanted the sound of those jets in my
room. Yeah. But you know, other great Bruckheimer movies, in my opinion. I mean, first off, National Treasure.
That is a fun movie.
That was the movie that I was expecting Da Vinci Code to be.
Yep.
And from what I understand, a lot of people were saying National Treasure was better than Da Vinci Code.
I've had the experience of reading the Da Vinci Code.
So have I.
The first movie that we did live for this for this podcast that we actually went to the theater, saw it, podcast immediately after was The Da Vinci Code. Basically because we heard there were going to be protests. And we wanted to interview protesters. And it turns out that the protesters decided not to protest at the theater that we were at.
So, what a shame.
I even had permission from the theater company
That's great.
It was great. It was great. And we did actually interview a couple of very nice ladies who were, I think their median age was probably late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And they were generous and just brilliant for their insight and into the movie and into the controversy that was genius marketing.
Which I roll my eyes at because I'm the first one to say, look, guys, it's a book.
Yeah.
I'm a born again Christian. You know, I got news for you. I read it. It was a fun romp. It was a book. Okay.
Right.
It's fiction.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. All right, here we go.
And that's exactly the commentary we got from these ladies. It was, you know, and I think the quote was something to the effect that if you're going to base your faith on this, what does that say about your faith?
Okay. Here's a fanboy exclusive. I've never told this story on a podcast before. I've never told the story outside of social circles.
Excellent.
And I'm not necessarily worried about alienating anybody because I haven't seen this chick on. I think her career is pretty much done. All right. she's an actress that was at a. She was at a con that I was one of the author guests at, and she was a media guest. Which I was really shocked about because her claim to fame was she was a reoccurring role in one season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Wow.
And then she was in a Prince video. And now she's a born-again Christian.
All right.
And she even recorded an audio book of her life at the tender age of 30. So
that's an incredible ego.
Oh, wait for it.
All right.
To quote what I said on Chuck Tomasi's Technorama. Oh wait, I'm not finished yet. So we're having our media guest dinner, and I guess she drew the short straw because she got put to the table where all the authors were sitting.
All right.
So it was her, and it was me, and it was a whole bunch of people, and and we started talking about you know, the process of getting published. And this was something that she was very interested in doing, because while she had an audiobook, it was more or less an independently published audiobook. And this was long before podcasting.
Sure.
So you know, I didn't know any better, but but we were talking about, you know, different avenues and things like that, and she went down the line. I was the last author she got to, and she said, you know, how, you know, what are your opinions on, you know, how tough is it to get published? And I said, it's not tough to get published. And I was the only author that said that. And she was looking at me like, I beg your pardon? I said, you could walk out of here right now, go to Kinko's.
Yep.
And get your book professionally bound, cover the whole shebang. You
exactly.
could do that. The hard part, and that's the whole reason behind the Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy. Mm-hmm. The whole part of the whole challenge, I personally think, of getting of being a writer isn't getting published. It's people buying your books.
Yeah.
There are tons of books that hit the market, not just the big market books, but the smaller press market books, the self-published books. So the publishing process is really not that big of a deal. It's actually getting people to walk out with your book in your hands. And I said, what you need is a marketing hook. You need something that's going to bring people in. And I said, take the Da Vinci Code, for example.
Yeah.
Her entire demeanor changed. And she got all feathers ruffled and things like that. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I forgot. She's a born-again Christian. And we were talking, and when I told her that I was also a born-again Christian, mm-hmm. she was like, oh, really? And, of course, I had her undivided attention. I'm like, uh-huh. Already I was seeing through this because she was just slamming the book. And left and right, people were throwing in their own comments about it. And and I finally said, well, you know what? You know where I'm coming from. Well, here's the thing. I enjoyed the book for what it was. And mm-hmm. she was like, and she went back on the sacrilegious thing. How could you say that? And I said, I enjoyed it for what it was. It was a terrific work of fiction. And I'm not kidding. She looked at me with the most serious face. And she looked at me. She said, it's fiction? You could have heard
wow.
a pin drop at this table. But wait, I'm not finished yet.
Oh, man.
Could she dig this hole any deeper? Oh, yeah, I think she could. Because I said, yeah, it says that at the beginning of the book. It's pretty much clear that this is a work of fiction. You did read the Da Vinci Code, right? No. This is what everyone's been telling me about the Da Vinci Code, that it was his dissertation about the... And I was like, no, it's a work of fiction.
Yeah.
And she is sitting at a table full of authors. And she's been slamming a book that she not only has never read, but she didn't even know was a novel. Mm. She thought it was nonfiction. She looked at all of us, and then she was like, oh, wait a minute, I'll be right back. And she never returned to the table for the rest of the night. And for the rest of the weekend, she didn't say two words to me.
Oh, I bet not. No.
I mean, you know, I mean, and that is where, that's where I think, you know, I just think people need to relax when it comes to that. Like your interviewer said, you know, or interviewee said, you know.
Right.
But yeah. Going back to Bruckheimer, I mean, I'm a fan of Bruckheimer films. There's some that I've loved, you know, like National Treasure, The Rock. I'm not a big fan of what was the one? Con Air. Not a big fan of Con Air.
Yeah, that one.
You know,
it was a little
over the top.
It was a little over the top.
Yeah, but this was a Bruckheimer vehicle. Deja vu.
Right.
And I was pleasantly surprised at how sharp and intelligent and how they solved the issue with they actually took a page out of a book from or out of the mentality of time travel that Paul Levinson, another sci-fi author, mm-hmm. has. Paul basically has this theory that time travel is more or less impossible, because if you go back in time, the power that is, you know,
right.
whether you want to call it God, Allah, what have you, is going to correct itself.
Yes.
It will make sure that no matter what happens, roughly the same outcome is going to happen.
Okay.
And you can't have a paradox. And the way they handled that in Deja Vu was very, very intelligent. I'm a big fan of Time Bandits. I'm a big fan of the movie time after time where Malcolm McDowell plays H.G. Wells and
David
Warner plays
Mentioned
Jack
that. Ripper. We mentioned that one too. Though I actually misattributed that to the Time Machine, but it was basically because it was H.G. Wells. I misspoke on the title of the film.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah.
But yeah, it was Time After Time.
Yeah, Time After Time. Great movie.
Yes.
And so anyway, so when you but what they did in Generations, obviously, just it really didn't work.
Right.
Now what they did in First Contact, which technically, yeah, that was a time travel movie, that worked.
Yeah, it did.
And I had a ball with with First Contact.
Now I've seen some people just absolutely rail First Contact, that it just pisses on everything that Gene Roddenberry did. And now, you know, I am not the biggest fan of Mr. Roddenberry specifically. Mm-hmm. And everything that I've heard about him and most of that has come from Harlan Ellison's book about City on the Edge of Forever, which it's Harlan, so you have to kind of take that with a grain of salt.
But I have
yeah. It's basically though that
Putz.
Yeah. It's basically though that Gene Roddenberry didn't allow for conflict among the characters. And it's obvious in the first couple of seasons of Next Generation, in the original series, there was no conflict amongst the core characters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you take a look at that and how groundbreaking that show was just to get the material on the air. But you don't have anything even approaching drama amongst the characters. And it's unfortunate because they, you know, for my money, I find it hard to go back and watch the original series and most of the Next Generation just because it's kind of bland. it's just, and I know that my taste has been flavored now by things like Battlestar Galactica, which is just completely
that's
different.
Like the dysfunctional family in outer space.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, and before you start getting the hate mail concerning my opinion on Harlan Ellison, I would just say flat out it's not against Harlan Ellison as the writer. I really have a tough time with somebody who bases their entire who appears apparently to be basing his entire career on how shocking he can be in public and how opinionated he can be in public versus standing by what he writes.
Yeah.
And I will leave it. I will leave that argument there.
I can understand.
And if people listening decide they're going to go to Harlan, you know, be it on a discussion board or at a sci-fi con, and they say to him, "Did you hear what T. Morris said about you?" He's going to look at him square in the eye and go, "I don't know who he is."
Yeah.
Fuck him. You know,
exactly. And you know what? If somebody quotes the Fanboy Smackdown to Harlan Ellison,
rock on.
I'm done. I'll hang up the mic right now. I'm done. That's it.
Thank you. Good night.
Exactly.
I can see what you're talking about with that. But I think that with, you know, you can only take so much of that. In my opinion, being dysfunctional.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why I didn't really click with Babylon 5. I mean, there was some, and it took a while for me to warm up to Battlestar Galactica because everyone was so dysfunctional. I mean, granted, there's the opposite end of the spectrum, which is Star Trek, where everybody's, you know, happy-go-lucky, get along well.
Right.
And, you know, I see the argument there. As far as the movies went, you know, First Contact for me was Wrath of Khan for the Next Generation.
Yes.
And then comes Insurrection. And this is where I think there's the great divide. Because I'm a sucker for what I call the kinder, gentler Star Trek Next Generation.
Right.
When people say, "What is your favorite episode?" I always go back to The Inner Light. The Inner Light was the episode where the probe latches onto Picard, and he lives out the other man's life.
Okay.
That's the one where at the very end, you know, if you are not weeping like a baby, you have no heart. I mean, there are certain endings that are going to make you cry.
Right.
The ending of Field of Dreams, the ending of Old Yeller, and the ending of The Inner Light. Yep. And in The Inner Light, that's the one where Riker comes in. He says, well, the probe had some type of self-destruct mechanism. You know, all the circuits were burned out, but we found this. And he hands Picard a box, and Picard opens the box, tells, you know, basically gives him the nod to leave. And then he pulls out the flute, holds it to his heart, you know, holds it close to his chest, and then he starts playing that song. Oh, yep. God, that great song. And to me, that same vibe was in Insurrection.
I enjoyed Insurrection. I really did.
I thought that was a very, very touching, very sweet Star Trek film. I really did.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. And then came Nemesis, and I will just... Next topic, please.
All right. Well, now you say you've never listened to Fanboy Smackdown before, but so far, the way you've handled our topic bounces, you had to have studied every one of them. This is generally how our shows go. We have a topic, and we meander through it, so...
And then we eventually get back to it.
And we're getting back to it right now because we're here to shill your book.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there was a reason for this. When I approached you to talk about this, I said, I want you to tell the listeners of the Fanboy Smackdown, since this is primarily a movie podcast, if they're a fan of what types of movies, what movies would translate well into, I like these movies, therefore I should definitely give Billabub Battings a listen to. You should give it a listen to anyway, but.
Which, by the way, that reminds me, thank you very much for re-gifting, the preview.
Hey, no problem.
I really do appreciate that. In fact, I was pleasantly surprised. I was hoping maybe one or two people would replay the Billabub Battings episode.
Right.
And I wound up having five podcasts step up.
Excellent.
And say,
excellent.
And say, we're going to feature this.
Well, I'm T, your timing was right giving it to us during the holidays.
Well, there is that.
Because we're all struggling for content with time and everything else. And it was like, I don't feel like doing anything. That's the holidays. Let's put this out there.
Yeah, let's just throw this in the feed. Which is fine.
No,
which is
absolutely,
because you know, that was the intent.
We're getting our gears back up and running. Probably before this one hits, the one right before this will be the episode that we recorded the night that Rocky Balboa was released. We saw it immediately, podcast right after it, and this will be old news for listeners, but we raved about it.
You know, for one thing, it seems to be getting consistent box office numbers.
Yes.
And I haven't really heard bad press about it. And I thought, wow, man, this is a bad idea. But now I'm looking at it going, oh, my God, this is like a sleeper hit.
This is the movie that Rocky 3, 4, or 5 should have been.
Wow.
And I say that with all confidence. This is probably the second best Rocky film.
Wow.
The first one being the best.
The best, right, sure.
See, the second one,
the thing about Sylvester
the second
Stallone,
was a,
I've
was
been
a
wanting him to have a hit for a
exactly,
long time.
Exactly.
Because
he is Rocky.
What?
He is Rocky. You
oh,
want
yeah,
him
he
to
is
do
Rocky,
well.
But,
you want him to
but
do
I don't think
great things.
He just needed something. He needed something to put him back in there because I saw Get Carter.
I heard about that.
And I loved it.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it because, one, Stallone was not playing a really, quote-unquote, good guy.
Right.
He was playing a really nasty good guy, a really nasty one. And there's a scene, and there's a flat-out brawl between him and Mickey Rourke in Get Carter. And, one, I didn't realize, you know, whenever I think of Mickey Rourke... I think of you know, skinny little Mickey Rourke telling Kim Basinger to, you know, do
right.
things to herself in 9.5 weeks.
Right.
You know,
the guy Mickey Rourke's a badass.
Yeah, exactly. Back in the day. And now, you know, when he took his, at one point he takes his jacket off, and I'm looking at him going, my God, the guy's a brick house.
Oh, yeah.
And he's now got that gravelly voice. In fact, the two things that made Sin City for me was the performance that Clive Owen turned in,
mm-hmm.
and the performance Mickey Rourke turned in.
Great.
With Bruce Willis coming in a close third.
Great performances.
Yeah, great performances. The movie was a little dark, a little too dark.
A little
for
bit,
me.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was exactly the comic book. It was exactly the graphic novel.
And I'm not questioning that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Frank Miller's work, not Sin City, but I know Frank Miller's work, and I love Frank Miller's work. But man,
if you ever have the opportunity, and are able to get a copy of the graphic novels of Sin City, mm-hmm. specifically, The Yellow Bastard and the other ones that were flat out from the graphic novels, you can hold the graphic novel up to the screen and it is exactly what you see. I mean,
and that's the
graphic novel was a storyboard specifically for the movie. It was exactly, angles, colors, everything was exactly the same.
And you know, you were asking me to make comparisons with Billy and certain films.
Yeah.
Sin City, if it, you know, don't go that dark, but that kind of feel.
All right.
You know, the very stylized dialogue, mm-hmm. the very stylized feel, that whole film noir kind of feel to it.
Right.
That I think is Billy Batty.
So it's and I've had the opportunity of listening to the first chapter and
right.
reading the ninth.
Reading. Oh yeah. Reading. That's true. Yes. Yes.
I would not have immediately thought of Sin City, but the hyper reality of it, of Sin City, I can see the translation there and I can definitely make the connection now that you mm-hmm. say it, that it's not, a realistic representation of the period, but it's a highly stylized version of it.
Yeah. Yeah. The book is as accurate as the story allows me to be. You know, Moravia is the same way too. I mean,
yeah.
You know, there are people that get all hepped up about, you know, combining history with fantasy and writing historical fiction anyway. And I tend to tell people, look, if you want accurate history down to the detail, I tell you what, there's some great history books that I can recommend.
Exactly.
But if you want some escapism that's got some historical chutzpah behind it, then okay, you're going to want to pick up my books.
Yep.
Because, you know, for example, you know, to use my first book, Moravi, which, yeah, it's available in print as well. It's also available on patiobooks.com.
Mm-hmm.
With Moravi, you know, I've got a swashbuckling privateer in the service of King Henry VIII.
Right.
Okay. Now, if I wanted to be historically accurate, there's no way that Ascanio Maldarin would have fallen in love with Ralph Rafton. Why? Because most of his teeth would be missing.
Yeah.
He'd have horrific breath. He'd stink. And then if there were to be some sort of romantic tryst involved, the minute he'd take off his shirt, she'd go running out the room because he'd be covered in syphilis sores.
Yeah.
You've got to draw the line somewhere. And I told people, look, if you want historical accuracy, you're going to get it, but it is only as accurate as the story allows me to be.
Right, right.
Now, I'm not going to go the Sam Raimi route that he did with Hercules and Xena and take extreme liberties. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go that far. But like with Billy, you know, I did my homework. The, mm-hmm. the slang that you hear, you know, that was the 1920s, 1930s
oh, yeah.
slang.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so you've got that aspect of Billy. You know, it's part Sin City. There's also a little bit of The Godfather mixed in there.
Yeah.
But actually, not The Godfather, The Untouchables.
Ah.
Every time, like I said, Al Capone is one of the baddies in Billy Batty's. And every time I was typing out Capone's dialogue, I always heard Robert De Niro.
That's great.
I loved the movie The Untouchables. I mean, that is just a brilliant, brilliant movie. And In fact, I even gave a nod to the film when in one of my chapter titles, which is called "Give Elliot My Regards," and that's when the G-men show up, you know, and you know try to find out from Billy, you know, what the real deal is, and so there's a little bit of the Untouchables mixed in there, so you're going to get that. As far as the fantasy aspect of it goes, the fantasy is in there, but I really can't think of any solid fantasy tie-ins that went this route. Now, there is coming up here, and probably by the time this airs, it would have already premiered. The Sci-Fi Channel is showing something called The Dresden Files.
Yes. Yeah, that'll
now, that's be... really, really close to, you know, and after I'd written Billy Batting's, people were going, oh, then you'd love The Dresden Files. And I was like, what are The Dresden Files? And that was when people started turning me on to Jim Butcher. Nice guy, Jim Butcher. Nice guy, Jim Butcher.
Cool.
And hell of an author. And I'm really thrilled that this is happening for him, The Dresden Files. And it's there's that kind of feel to it as well. So you have that aspect of it. You
All know? Right.
And then finally, let's see if there's... If there's anything else that I would say that you might find in this book, you might find a touch of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Okay.
Mainly because, you know, I talk about archaeological digs in Egypt and you know, ancient artifacts with hidden power, and you know, I just that first Raiders movie, you just can't touch it.
No.
You know.
No.
You know.
That is a phenomenal.
I still remember.
Movie.
I still remember we had a family friend that owned his own movie theater, and he let us in. Yeah,
jealous.
Gets better. He let us in the movies for free because he was friends with my dad's.
Wow.
Some of the movies that I saw at his theater, I saw Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan on opening night, free of charge.
Nice.
Silver Streak, Rocky II, Rocky III. Let's see, and then he called up my family. And he said, I'm having a sneak preview at my theater tonight. T's going to want to be here. I've seen the rough cut, and he's going to want to see it. And they said, what's the name of the movie? And he said, it's called Raiders of the Lost Ark. So he got me in, and he said, you know, and he had a seat set aside for me. And he said, tell me what you think afterwards. And he walks out. And I walked out of the movie theater, and Mr. Robinson came up to me and said, so T, what'd you think? And I said, I don't know what to say. I mean, I was exhausted. I was absolutely drained after that.
Oh, man. And, yeah. Have you ever had the opportunity to read the script?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've got the illustrated, script.
I mean, even here. there was a few things that were lost from the script that really made the character of Indiana Jones a bit darker than what he appeared in this film. Was the relationship with Marion was quite different.
I bet.
And because I think even in the script they specifically spelled out how old she was. And if you followed the timeline,
yeah,
it's been
a while since I've read it. Yeah,
either she was just infatuated with him and he did nothing to stop it, or there was something really wrong. But they played that character the same way though, that she was a hard person at a fairly young age,
mm-hmm.
Which was a really interesting take for a female character at the time. I mean, that was Starbuck. Starbuck.
I find funny, I've always been big into the reviewers, you know, and their picks and stuff like that. And I remember Robert and Ebert, mm-hmm. those guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, when they were both alive. No, Siskel and Ebert did a show about the decline of the female role in Hollywood. Now, this was the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And they were, and they used Raiders of the Lost Ark as one example, and they used a couple others with tough talking women in them. And they were talking about how women are no longer allowed to be women. They're just one of the boys and yada, yada, yada. And I'm looking at them going, guys, are you all on crack? They're women that are independent and they're strong characters.
Exactly.
Now, here was what was so funny. So, you know, and they weren't the only ones that were saying this. Siskel and Ebert weren't the only ones. There were a lot of people that were saying, you know, they're just men with different, you know, with different plumbing.
Right.
You know? So then what happens? Well, then all of a sudden we get all these fluffy romantic comedy films and all these fluffy female roles where the woman is always the victim and always in the corner. And then we had, of course, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
You know, Kate Capshaw was real pretty to look at, but pretty much she stood in the corner and said, save me, Indy, save me.
Right.
Throughout the entire movie. That got real old real quick. And then what happened? All these film reviewers stepped forward and were saying things like, you know, women have become these, you know, set dressings. They've become this, they've become that. And I'm sitting there going, you guys just aren't happy anytime you go to the movies.
You know, since I've taken a more critical eye to movie reviewers, especially in the last year or so since doing this podcast, what I've found really interesting is the number of reviewers that will say things just to be different and just to have a byline.
Right.
I mean, I've been consistent throughout my reviews. I plan on staying that. And if somebody changes my mind, I'll admit when something's changed my mind and it changes. But you know what? I defend episode one of Star Wars for what it's
You're
worth.
You're a better man than I.
I defend it. I defend it for the kids movie that it is. It's the same kids movie that I saw when I was 6 years old and saw Star Wars for the first time.
See, I had a very brief stint as a movie.
Well, I was going to say, and for me, that's what it is. And, it all goes back to Star Wars for me just because the arguments that I find most people make against the newer trilogy, if you hold about 75% of those arguments up against the original trilogy, the arguments are just as valid.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm the first one to say, I mean, cause I used to review movies for, before slice, actually it was for a brief while for Slice of Sci-Fi,
okay.
But also for Cover to Cover, Dragon Page with Mike and Evo.
Yep.
I was their movie reviewer for a while and, I gave it up for two reasons. One, I gave it up because it got a little sticky.
Yeah.
It got a little sticky because I was not doing the popular. I wasn't doing the popular stuff. Mm-hmm. I was basically saying, you know, this is, you know, I'm going to see that this is what I think.
Mm-hmm.
And and in fact, I also got into some hot water when I wrote an article. It was actually inspired by by one of the reactions to a movie review that I made, and also to something I heard at a convention.
Okay.
I basically did an article about elitism in science fiction and fantasy.
And
in fact,
I even remember
what the movie was that really set people against me.
Okay.
It's Van Helsing. It's Van Helsing.
Yes.
In my opinion, one of the best movies I saw that summer.
That was a fun movie.
Thank you.
It was.
Because you know, the people that were going in and they're going, oh, it was this, you know, they were just slamming on it. I then said, and then they would turn to me and they go, what did you think? I said, I thought it was brilliant.
It was just,
what are you talking about?
Goofy as anything else. And it was brilliant for its fun.
And that was what I said. I said, think about this for 1 second. You all are approaching this movie as if it's Lord of the Frickin' Rings.
Yeah.
This is a movie. Look at the characters. You've got Dracula. You've got the Wolfman. You've got, you know, Frankenstein's monster. And then you've got Van Helsing as like a glorified James Bond working for the Vatican. And you're expecting cinematic brilliance? This is Hammer House of Horror.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, The Curse of Frankenstein and The Bride of Dracula. These are the Saturday morning popcorn matinees. You know, turn your brain off.
Yep.
And just enjoy it for what it is. And
this this actually goes to the heart of, and I've told this story on myself a couple times, the heart of what the Fanboy Smackdown was supposed to be. It was originally going to be a podcast that was anti-elitism in the genre community. The problem was I realized quickly that I'd probably have three people listening to me. and those that were the ones that just stuck around long enough to bitch about it. And,
you know,
you can only be negative for so long in that
but
respect.
But what I found out about that article when I wrote it was that there was a very strong divide. There are the fans that want that elitism in science fiction and fantasy, and then they can't understand why science fiction and fantasy is not embraced more by the mainstream.
Right.
And I'm sitting there going, well, we kind of bring this on ourselves as fans. And if we want it to stop, if we want to tell people, look, take a look at Battlestar Galactica, take a look at Eureka, take a look at the Dresden Files. You know, for example, Heroes. For the longest time, NBC did not say that Heroes was basically a comic book.
Right.
It was a comic book for TV. They did not say that. They refused to come out and say that.
Yep.
If you pick up USA Today, if you pick up today's USA Today, which actually it's tomorrow, but if you pick up yesterday's USA Today, they did a recap of the first half of the season, and they did it in the style of what? A comic book.
Sure.
Why? Because they've established themselves.
Well,
now.
Because that's and what because it is.
That's what it is. But again, why didn't NBC come out and say that? Because they didn't want to alienate people that thought it was going to be, quote unquote, one of those comic book things, you know? So,
and
we bring this on ourselves.
And what's kind of funny with that is that, you know, people want to distance themselves from it being a comic book. And this is an argument that I've heard on some other shows that, you know, one, why is there nothing new coming out of Hollywood? Why can't they make things just like they were in the original source material? Things like that. Well, for one thing, if you look at the average comic book, just looking at a comic book, you have a subscribership of, if you're really lucky, 100,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
To sell 100,000 movie tickets, you're not doing that great.
No, unless you're doing like an indie film out of the basement of somebody's, you know, coffee shop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You really don't to make a movie like Spider-Man and to make it exactly like if you're going to make that purely for people who read comic books and basically say piss on everybody else.
Yeah.
I don't want anyone who's never read a comic book to watch it. You're not making that movie.
No, you're not.
You're making Spider-Babe.
Yeah, exactly. Ah, bada bing. Yeah.
You know?
I haven't seen Spider-Babe yet. I've been meaning to get Joe's copy of that. But
if you skim Skinemax long enough, once every couple of months, it shows up.
I mean, again, but where I drew the line as a movie reviewer was when people started getting personal in their arguments against me. And then they started putting words in my mouth. This one fan of the of Cover to Cover and Slice of Sci-Fi started just digging me a grave. You know, was just slamming me against the wall. And I posted a reply to her post.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Okay, you said that I said this, and I said this, and I said this in my article. Where did I say it?
Right.
Where did I say that? Because I never said that. I don't mind a different opinion of mine. You start putting words in my mouth, I've got a problem with that."
Yeah.
Her reply to it was, "Oh, we have sour grapes, don't we?" And she never told me in the article. And, you know, and this is my biggest problem with it. I cannot have, you know, if you don't like something that I do, that I'm passionate about, I can go on ahead and have an intelligent conversation with you about it.
Sure.
But if you say that you've never read the book, if you say that I said this when, and but then I ask you, well, where did I say that? And you can't find it. You know, I don't play that game at all. And I just, you know, I basically said to the guys, you know, I think I better be focusing more on my writing. And I stopped.
Yeah.
You know, reviewing movies, you know, I even thought about doing a movie review podcast. And I said, you know, I just don't want to open up that can of worms again.
It's, so, you know, it's, we've got a, I mean, it's, we don't have a really large listenership for this one. But the folks that listen to us respond to us and, we, you know, we've solicited comments. We've had one off comment question from one of our listeners lead to the next three shows that we've done. but, you know, at the same time, I've had people come out and say, you're insane for your opinions. The thing is, and my co-host and I on a regular basis, we disagree, but you know, that's just the way it is. The beautiful thing about, fiction and entertainment is it's not for everyone. Everyone has their own tastes. And,
yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I make it pretty clear what my tastes are. I can enjoy Star Wars. I can enjoy Steel Magnolias. I can enjoy The Breakup. I can enjoy Cars. All films that I can watch multiple times and get enjoyment out of. There are some films that I do not like, and I know that I don't like them for ridiculous reasons, and I will state that I don't like them for ridiculous reasons.
And you will, and you will, and you will stand by those ridiculous
exactly.
reasons. I mean, and there are some films, like, for example, and I know there are some films that I just can't, I can't watch.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't have a desire to watch. There are, I mean, for example, I just recently got petitioned by SAG to go see Babel.
Oh, okay.
I have no desire to see that movie whatsoever. Mm-hmm. None. I mean, I just don't want to be put through that type of mental anguish for, you know, however many hours it is.
Right.
When I was sick and in bed and I was like, I need something to watch, I had a copy of Capote.
Okay.
Brilliant film. I mean, you know, Philip C. Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
Just phenomenal as Capote. Absolutely phenomenal.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Of course, now, whenever I see him in Mission Impossible 3, I'm going to want him to say, you have an explosive charge in your head. You know, that's the way I want him to deliver the line now. But, again, another great movie was Mission Impossible 3. I can sit down and watch that, have a blast right. watching that movie.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, I'm at the have a job, have a 4-year-old trying to podcast
exactly.
state. And for the nice thing about doing the podcast that we do is we haven't pigeonholed ourselves into new movies, which is really great considering I haven't had a chance to see too many new ones recently.
Well, even with the older movies, I mean, some of the older movies that I look back on, I mean, you know, I love the film Amadeus. I love the mm-hmm. film Bubba Hotep.
Bubba Hotep is hilarious.
Oh my God. It's just genius.
Yep.
And then there are the movies. In fact, I remember Joe Murphy gave me a grilling about this one. And I still rave about it, even when I teach a class in video editing. I always say, if you want to see exactly what you can do with a Macintosh and Final Cut Pro and post-production software, you want to see Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I've had a couple people say, you know, Joe Murphy being one of them, he said it wasn't that good, and I said, no, it was that brilliant.
That was
it
a
was
fun
the movie,
movie
Dick Tracy wanted to be.
Yep.
Sky
yeah.
Captain was just wonderful.
That was a fun movie.
I mean, it was just goofy, fun, and I mean, and just down to the sound effects
mm-hmm.
when they used the old George Powell War of the Worlds heat ray sound
yeah.
effects for the killer robots.
Yeah,
man, I was grinning like a Cheshire cat because I knew that this movie was not trying to be anything but a Saturday morning serial.
Exactly.
And I ate it up. And And also, we had Angelina Jolie in an eye patch.
Her outfit was primo. That was good stuff.
Yummy. Yummy.
Yep.
But so I mean, there are, you know, my movies are across the board. My movies are all across the board. And all I ask is that when I go into the movie, that I don't, if it's a movie that is so dreary and so lackluster of hope, I mean, of course I'm just going to say, you know, I want my money back, you know?
Yeah.
I want those 2 hours of my life back. If it's overly polished and overly perfect, no, I'm not going to enjoy that either.
Right.
I mean, it's really tough for me to say what I like and what I don't like. What I know I enjoy is I enjoy movies that surprise me, and I enjoy movies that entertain me.
That's where it
comes down.
I can see that and agree with it. For me, it's if I understand going into a movie what the expectations are of what I'm supposed to get out of the movie, and if I get that from a movie, I'm good with that. We went and saw Snakes on a Plane. And you know what? I saw Snakes, and they were on a plane.
On a plane.
And I heard, you know, get these motherfucking snakes off my motherfucking plane.
Snakes off my motherfucking plane.
You know what? Done. That was those 30 seconds worth of stuff was there, and I enjoyed it. And everything else that was there was a pleasant surprise.
Right.
That it actually had a story that, while goofy, made sense. And you could actually follow the plot. It wasn't high art. And you can tell where it was a PG-13 movie that they edited to an R-rated movie. But knowing that made spotting those moments all the more fun.
I was sorry I missed it. I'm sorry I missed Snakes on a Plane. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that if you get the chance, rent it.
Absolutely.
And watch for those moments because they are very, very easy to spot. I mean, the scene where Sam Jackson utters the line, you can tell it was done at a completely different time. Because he's the only one even... It looks like he's the only one on the plane when he says it. It's great. But, you know, there are movies that I like that other people just look at me like I'm insane for. And that's fine. My wife and I went and saw The Breakup, the Jennifer Aniston, Vince Vaughn movie.
Right,
Billed as a romantic comedy.
Chick flick.
Billed as a romantic comedy. Billed as a chick flick.
Right.
Walked out of the movie. My wife hated this movie with a violent passion. I walked out of it saying it was brilliant. I own a copy of it now. I got a copy of it for Christmas. But it's one of those movies that was horribly mismarketed. It is not, it's not a romantic comedy. It's, at best, a very, very dark comedy. I would more likely call it a drama with Vince Vaughn being funny in it. It is what it is. It is a movie about people breaking up. And it's hard to watch in places. It's it's rough. They say things that are mean. But if you've ever been involved in a relationship that went south, you've been there and you can relate. And parts of it, you know, if you go into this movie expecting a comedy and you get that experience from it, it's, you walk out of that with a bad taste in your mouth. But for me, it was about the experience, and I enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed the movie.
Yeah,
I thought it was a fine piece of acting.
Yeah, that was the movie that movie was Van Helsing.
Yeah.
Which I saw multiple times in the theater, which people thought I was completely on crack. And I said it, you know, and I was honest with people. I said it is not a perfect film.
No.
If it was missing one element, and if it had that one element, it would have been the perfect film. All I needed to make that movie perfect was to have somewhere Christopher Lee cross the street. If yep. there had been one quick cameo by Christopher Lee, and he could have made the time for it.
Yeah.
Okay? He could have made the time. If they had found one moment to feature Christopher Lee, you know, the king of the, you know, alongside of Peter Cushing in those terrific Hammer House of Horror films.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I would have said, okay, I'm done. This is a brilliant piece of cinematic art.
You know, I saw that movie, rented it from Netflix because I had heard how bad it was. Mm-hmm. And I said, I just have to see this movie for myself. I enjoy Hugh Jackman. I remember seeing the previews of it and thinking this could be a really cool movie. Hearing how bad it was, I just have to rent it for myself. And I sat there and watched the whole movie, expecting after the first 20 minutes to want to turn it off. 20 minutes in, I give it another 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And I just kept going with it. And it was like, I don't get it.
And it was Kate Beckinsale in a corset with firearms. Come on.
I was sitting there going, I don't understand what people don't like about this movie. It's fun.
What is there not to like in the movie? That's what I want to know. I mean, this was just, like I said, it was just good popcorn. And here was another movie that people really didn't like. And I thought, and I even saw it like a second time, and I thought, this is actually getting better every time I see it. The Punisher.
Yeah.
Not the one with Dolph Lundgren.
the one that they named the Punisher that really wasn't the Punisher.
The what?
The Dolph Lundgren movie that they called The Punisher.
Yeah. And they slapped Stan Lee's name on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
The reason why I think a lot of people did not care for The Punisher, and I'm also in the camp of I also really dug Daredevil.
I like Daredevil.
And the reason
I even liked the theatrical cut of Daredevil.
That's the only one I've seen. I've got the director's cut here, and I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch it yet.
The exact same way. I own both copies, but I haven't had the chance to watch the director's cut yet.
But the thing about Daredevil and especially The Punisher, if you go into The Punisher expecting to see Spider-Man or even Hulk or Fantastic Four, you're not going to get it.
No.
The Punisher was dark.
Yep.
The Punisher was nasty. The Punisher was Batman on steroids.
Yeah.
And, you know, whereas with Batman was a crusader. You know, he still had his redeeming qualities. He still had those moments where, you know, this is justice. Punisher? No. It's black and white. He was judge, jury, and executioner.
And Punisher, I to this day, it would have been nice to see a story that, and I know Marvel's never going to do this just because he's still making money, is just to have Frank Castle die in a gunfight, you know, to have him go out in that blaze of glory, because that's really all he wants.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
he's going to take as many of these bastards as he can down until he goes down.
Right.
And when he goes down, will be it.
But that's what I think is that if you go into The Punisher thinking that it's a comic, that it is a superhero stories, it's a superhero story. It's not.
Right.
You know, this is not Batman done by Marvel.
Right.
This is Marvel's take on what would happen if the wrong man was turned into a vigilante. Because let's face it, Frank Castle is the wrong man you'd want to be turned into a vigilante.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because he's got the training. He's got the ability. He's got the smarts. And now he's got the firepower.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, so I thought The Punisher was wonderful.
And I thought The Hulk was a great movie.
Oh, now here's where it becomes a smackdown.
That's fine.
Oh, piece of shit.
You know what?
I kept sitting there thinking to myself, the same brilliant man behind Sense and Sensibility and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is giving me this. Now, I will say this. I do not like Eric Bana.
Okay.
I think Eric Bana, the last time I saw something that stiff, it was the Lee Harvey Oswald Prison Exchange. Okay.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I just find him real. Every time he's on the screen, I squirm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that way during My Big Fat Greek Invasion. I'm sorry, Troy. But I mean, the Hulk, the one thing I will say about the Hulk that I really liked was what Ang Lee tried to do,
mm-hmm.
where he took the movie screen and divided it up into panels.
Yes.
That was cool.
Yes. Now,
that was not enough to get me through.
Now see, my defense of the Hulk is... for one thing, one of the arguments is what you said, Eric Bana, wooden actor. Okay. But the character, Bruce Banner, David Banner, whatever the hell they called him for this version of it, he was Bruce in this one, I think. He was trying to be non-emotional. The more emotional he got, the worse off it became. So that I actually took as part of the character. Whether that was his acting or not, I really didn't have that much experience with the actor when I saw that film. But the other
thing I've seen, yeah.
But the other thing that for me that I just loved was what you said about the Punisher, was that you can't go to see the Hulk and expect a comic book movie, because the Hulk is not a superhero. The Hulk has never been a superhero, and the Hulk has always been a monster. It's always been about the story of a monster. It's been Frankenstein. And the movie The Hulk as a monster movie was, for me, worked very well.
I think another thing that was bothering me, though, about Hulk, the film, was Nick Nolte. I don't know what he was on, but, man, they needed double the dosage. I just felt like he was in an entirely different movie.
I'll give you that one. I will give you that. I will give you Nick Nolte on that one, yeah.
between Nick Nolte and between Nick Nolte and Eric Bana, I just was like, this movie just isn't doing anything for me. Really, really isn't.
And see, that's what's great about entertainment, is that we can have all these other common interests, and there are going to be things that just don't sync up.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I agree. And that's, I'm always leery of films that when people say, oh, you have to see it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm even guilty of saying it too.
Oh yeah.
And I'm trying to actually break the habit of saying, you have to see this, you have to see this, you have to see this.
Right. That's been one thing that I've had to be a lot more conscious about since starting the podcast, especially around members of my family, because they know that I do this and they ask my opinions on the movies. And, you know, it's kind of hard because I've gotten into the habit of being very honest in the podcast about what I think about movies. And if somebody says, oh, I like that, and I really didn't like it, I'll tell them. And then they look at you like, you're not supposed to tell people you don't like something when they tell you
exactly.
You're not supposed to be negative about things. Sorry.
I mean, a lot of people say that, I was in the minority when Mission Impossible 2 came out. Everybody thought that Mission Impossible 2 was this great, terrific, slick, great, terrific, slick film. And I watched it and I said to myself, it's John Woo masturbating.
I really
did not enjoy it. And
I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it for what it was, but that's exactly what
enjoy
it was.
For what it was. Whereas Mission Impossible 3, I was all over that. I was all over MI3.
Right.
I think the reason why MI3 didn't do as well as it could have done is that Tom Cruise fired his publicist. And,
yeah.
He has got to learn that he is an actor.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to learn that he's an actor. And actors, and I'm speaking from experience, I'm a card-carrying member of SAG myself, actors work best with scripts.
Yeah.
And before you open your mouth and say something, think about it real, real hard. When I was at the PMEs, someone said, T, when I listen to Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy, and it's just, you sound so natural, you sound so relaxed. What's your secret? And I look at him and I go, editing. Lots and lots of editing.
Exactly.
Because there are times that I've actually listened to something I've said and I go, oh, absolutely not. Just cut that, There's some stuff on the cutting room floor that could have absolutely cost me a writer's career.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think we've done any of that this evening. So
No, because yeah, no, not even calling Harlan Ellison a putz. But you know, if you're gonna, when you grab Connie Willis's boob on the stage for the Hugos, for the most prestigious science fiction writers award, you know, I'm sorry, but
yeah,
you descend to putz level for me at that point.
Right, right, exactly. Well, I'm looking at the time here, and we've gone a little long. which we knew would be the danger.
I guess this is the fanboy cage match smackdown, you know.
And you know what? That's fine. I'm more than cool with it. I want to thank you so much for coming on to.
Now this has been a real delight. This has been a real pleasure.
And you are more than welcome back anytime. we enjoy talking about film, so One of the things that we held out early on here on our show is, and you can go back and verify this, we actually had commentary after our second episode, which we were amazed at. We had some feedback because we didn't really advertise that the show even existed.
right.
Somebody just found us on the Libsyn feed, which I was just amazed at. he found us on the Libsyn feed. Gave our show a listen to, sent us an email with some feedback. Our first two shows were, the first one was strictly about Star Wars. The second one was everything else George Lucas has done before Star Wars.
Wow.
So we talked about THX 1138, American Graffiti, and then we...
Howard the Duck.
Well, that happened after. So,
we just talked about
kind of before Star Wars, his early in his career. And we kind of touched a little bit later, but we were then pointed out to a film called Alexander Nevsky, which I hadn't, honestly had never heard of before. It's a, I believe it's a 1938 Russian propaganda film. And it was pointed to us that if you want to see what some of George Lucas's, inspirations were for some of the stuff in Star Wars, check this movie out. So we immediately went out and rented the film. You know, for us, it's about, you know, sharing this experience with as many people as we can. If somebody suggests a film that we should check out, we'll go check it out. And
let's make some tentative return dates for me.
Cool.
I would love to come back on Fanboy Smackdown, and geek out over the season of 24.
Excellent.
Definitely, let's do that. And if there's any way we can conference call in Scott Sigler, I think we should try that.
That would be brilliant. it would
take some serious juggling, but I think a 24 wrap up on Fanboy Smackdown would be a lot of fun to do.
That sounds great to me.
Now here's the other thing. Another thing, if you'd be interested in doing is. You know, you're talking about going back to the classics. Well, I'll tell you one that was just recently. It was just recently on on AMC, and either we could do an entire show themed around like movies 20 years older and on.
All right,
but AMC was recently showing Conan the Barbarian a lot, and I was like, "Wow, this movie, the original,
yeah,
the original." And even edited for television and stuff, it still just stands up. And it's just, you know, I mean, I'm like, wow, this movie is great.
That is a fun
movie. But then just recently, AMC showed Metropolis.
That is, oh.
Have you ever seen Metropolis?
Yes.
Have you ever seen I mean.
I own it.
You know, yeah.
I own a copy.
I don't, and I need to.
I own a copy of Metropolis. It's actually, I have this weird little mental tick that whenever I get a new piece of technology, the first media that I play in it has to be something meaningful. Mm-hmm. So the first DVD or the first CD player I ever owned, I actually owned the CD for a good 6 months before I got the player, because because, you know, the player was like $200 or $300 at the time.
Sure.
And,
sure.
And I was just in high school, so I couldn't afford it. Actually it wasn't until I graduated from high school, was in college, that I actually got my first CD player. I owned the EP for Queensryche, the first EP, because it had an unreleased track that you could only get on the CD.
Oh, right.
Now it has since been previously unreleased on about four other CDs that they've released. But that was just something I just had to do. So when I got my first DVD player, I had already purchased a copy of Metropolis, and that was the first DVD that I watched in the DVD player.
Yeah.
Just because it was one of those things that it just had to do it.
Last time I was out in, Phoenix, Arizona, and I was visiting with Mike.
Mm-hmm.
We actually watched, he had on his Netflix, Metropolis.
Yeah.
And he popped it in and he was like, no, I'd never seen it before. So I sat down with him, and this wasn't the one that was remixed with, you know, Giorgio Moroder music and had music from Freddie Mercury and Bonnie Hart and all that
right.
stuff. Or Bonnie Hart. Yeah. This was actually one where they reconstructed a lot of the lost scenes of Metropolis. And then they even went even further, and they tried to find the original score. They tried to do the original score that may have appeared with Metropolis, the film.
I think that might be the version of it I have.
And, you know, if Fanboy Smackdown wanted to go really old school and talk about Metropolis, I will sit in on that conversation.
Excellent. Excellent.
Or if we just want to talk about, you know, what makes a film stand the test of time, and we can then talk about other films like Conan and, you know, like Goldfinger from the 1960s and, you know, movies like that.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you know, so let's think about a Metropolis themed show. And then on top of that, you know, definitely at the end of the season of 24, I'll come back on a Fanboy Smackdown and we'll hash it out.
Excellent.
We'll talk about Jack.
That sounds great to me, man.
All right. Great.
All right.
Thank you so much for being on the show. And I look forward to, you and your listeners, you know, joining me for the Bilbo Battings podcast.
Absolutely.
Launching on Valentine's Day.
Great. Thanks again, T.
You bet. Oh, wait. Almost forgot.
Yeah.
If you're wondering where to subscribe
exactly,
to the
Bilbo
Battings podcast.
It will be in the show notes, but also go ahead and give it here.
you can do a search in iTunes under T. Morris, TEEMORRIS, and the Bilbo Battings podcast will pop up. You can also go to tmorris.com, and there is a Bilbo Battings banner. And you just click on the Billy banner. It'll take you straight to the blog, and you can subscribe there.
Good enough.
That'll do it. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, sir.
I'm done.
All right.
Well, thanks again, Tony. This has been a real hoot.
Hey, thanks, T. All right. And, hey, you guys know how to get a hold of us, and we'll catch you next time.
FanboySmackdown.com.
Get thee back, Satan, you know?